The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Hello, good morning to you everybody. I'm sure you're all very upbeat today, three-day weekend coming up, and hope you have some nice weather. And those of you who have been importuned by the hurricane, hopefully we'll be able to get some respite from the travails and enjoy some relaxing time. Well, we just had the unemployment figures that came out for the month of August, and they showed no change at all. No new jobs were created. What is actually interesting about that is that the birth-death model, of course, which is, I've discussed many times, is responsible for a lot of the jobs that do exist. Without those, we'd certainly be looking at a negative number. But interestingly enough, spending went up last month. So quite frankly, if the hours worked edged down, which they did, then quite clearly the spending is taking place because of new credit card usage. People seem to have shrugged off the experience of the last few years. They're up to their old tricks, spending money they don't have yet again. Very, very depressing. So one other thing you might like to know about the figures is that the household survey of those totally employed fell by 49,000, but the population increased by 200,000. So clearly we needed those 200,000 extra jobs, which we didn't get, just to keep the employment rate constant. So basically what this means is that the country lost 250,000 jobs. Well, they won't tell you that, of course, but the math speaks for itself. So the situation is actually, as usual, much worse than they imply. And, you know, it does cause immense confusion, and I fully appreciate that. So what really is going on with the economy? Well, oddly enough, it's not that hard to explain, and it certainly doesn't require a master's in economics to grasp the main points. To begin with, let's just state the obvious. We're in a depression. Yes, that is a judgment call. But for 90% of working people in the United States, the word depression actually describes the slump that we're in. Well, secondly, the political process is broken. Now, I don't talk politics, so I'm not getting into it, but, you know, this fact is so obvious that it's really hardly worth mentioning. The vast majority of people are thoroughly disgusted with the craven Wall Street duopoly that masquerades as representative government. Representative of who? Corporate cats and bank vermin? American democracy, so-called, is a contradiction in terms. It is a complete farce. Neither party has any plan for lowering unemployment, correcting chronic trade imbalances, re-regulating the financial system, or growing the economy, as they say. Capitol Hill is merely an annex of Wall Street, just as the White House is entirely in the clutches of the brandy-swilling swine who run the big brokerage houses and hedge funds. They own it all, every bit of it. America is just one of many properties in their sordid portfolio. U.S. households are still underwater 3 full years after Lehman Brothers croaked. has shed a good portion of their debts through default, foreclosure, personal bankruptcy, and accelerated repayments. But the situation is still grave. There's lots more red ink to mop up. And now that Obama's $787 billion fiscal stimulus has run out, it's going to be a lot harder for them to clear their balance sheets. And the reason for that is that government spending reduces the real value of debt, making deleveraging easier. But, as you may have noticed, the government's share of total spending is actually shrinking. State and local governments are cutting costs and laying off workers as fast as they can. Over 500,000 state workers were fired in the last year and a half alone. That is what we call a disaster. And the idiot Obama hasn't lifted a finger to reverse the trend. Instead, he's taken a sabbatical to Martha's Vineyard to see if he can shave a few strokes off his golf game. What a terrible president. Anyway, household debt as a share of annual disposable income is currently 115%, down from 135% in 2008. Economists believe that the figure will eventually return to its historic range of 75%. And there's the rub, because if consumers continue to slash spending and increase savings, as they need to do, then the economy will slow down even more, greasing the skids for another vicious downturn. Consider this. In the peak bubble years of 2003 to 2008, U.S. households withdrew roughly $2.3 trillion from the home equity to spend as they pleased. Ironically, only about 20% of that sum was used in home improvements. The rest was used to pay off medical bills, credit card debt, and, yes, discretionary spending. Don't workers deserve an extra occasional night on the town? So, in other words, the housing bubble provided $500 billion in extra consumption per year for 5 years, and it was all borrowed money. Now, keep in mind, Obama's stimulus was $800 billion, but that amount was spent over a two-year period. So the $500 a year siphoned from home equity actually exceeded that of the debts that will take years to pay off. That means consumption, which traditionally leads the way out of recession, will flag, demand will remain weak, business investment will dwindle, unemployment will stay high, and the economy will continue to drift sideways. So what does all this tell us about the so-called recovery? The recovery, ladies and gentlemen, was just another public relations fable with no basis in fact. Just look at the trajectory of GDP since 2009, and you'll see what I mean. First quarter 2010, 3.9%. Second quarter 2010, 3.8%. Third quarter 2010, 2.5%. Fourth quarter 2010, 2.3%. First quarter 2011, 0.4%. Revised second quarter 2011, 0.9%. The only question about this that I have to ask myself is, how did the pundits, you know, government, Wall Street, business, the media, how did they get away with persuading everyone that the country was in recovery? How the hell did they do that? How did they succeed in convincing anyone who would listen that a country whose GDP went in a straight line down from 3.9% to 0.9% was in a recovery? No, seriously, I was on here twice a week, every single week, without one single exception during that entire period, screaming and yelling that there was no recovery. How did I do that? Am I a genius? Am I somehow gifted with clairvoyance? Do I have a better way with figures? Absolutely none of the above. I just took things at their face value and refused to listen to what I was being told. It's just a sales pitch. Do you always buy everything you're offered? No, of course not. So why would you buy economic interpretations from people you know have an axe to grind? So now, as we sit here at the beginning of September 2011, I have a new question which needs an answer badly. Who exactly is going to spend enough money to keep the economy bobbing along in positive territory? Big business? No way. Why would businesses make more products for people who have no money? Consumers? Nope. They died and went to heaven in the crash of 2008. The only one who can maintain spending and levitate the economy while households get their balance sheets together is the government. But that means bigger deficits, which both parties oppose, so nothing is going to get done. Oh yeah, there'll be more pompous pronouncements and political wrangling, but there won't be any big policy changes. The payroll tax holiday will end in December. Unemployment benefits will get slashed, housing prices will continue to stumble, and by election time, the economy will be in a total wreck. Bottom line, the economic process is broken, and the economy is going to tank. Ladies and gentlemen, you can bet on it. Okay, here I am with my information. And it is the same. Richard Martin, The Wake Up Call, Singapore, New York, you know the drill. The toll-free number, you may know it, but you could fool me. It is 888-874-4888. Again, 888-874-4888. Again, 888-874-4888. Well, it won't do you much good if you're sitting by the seashore at the weekend enjoying this program on your iPods or whatever it is you do, but please bear in mind that we are here to help you, to listen to you, and to take your calls. So avail yourselves, ladies and gentlemen, of the possibilities. If you want to write in, of course you can. My email address is rm@gfawd.com. Again, that's rm for Richard Martin at gfawd for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design. gfawd.com. Once more, rm@gfawd.com. And finally, my personal number, which is available, yes, even throughout this weekend. You may call me. I shall be nearby and hopefully able to help out within a few minutes or hours at the most. My number here is, in an area code at Sarasota, Florida, 941-441-1682. Again, 941-441-1682. Now, please bear in mind that there will be no show on Monday. That is, no show. PRN will be closed. So, by all means, listen to the archives, but don't ask any questions. There won't be anybody to answer you. So, no show on Monday. Right. Well, when I start to prepare these talks each week, which, by the way, is an ongoing process that takes shape throughout the entire week or the weekend, I really and truly have no idea what I'm going to talk about. And it's much like when you walk into a restaurant and you really haven't got a clue what you're going to eat until you get the menu, and then you sort of slowly come around to a decision. And actually, after years of going to restaurants with my wife and choosing the most boring thing on the menu and watching my wife enjoy all those exotic dishes right opposite me, I finally gave in, and from then on I bestowed upon her the awesome task of choosing my food for me. And now, of course, I eat like a king every time we go out, and I wouldn't have it any other way. Well, in that vein, my twice-weekly menu of choices for the wake-up call seems to have me frequently coming back to wanting to talk about the Fed. I don't know why this is. It just seems to bubble up into my consciousness, especially with every new outrage we get to hear about on an ongoing basis, not least of which my discussion last Monday of the secret bailouts. You know, the Fed is so outrageously corrupt, words do not do justice to a proper analysis of its crimes. It has become clear that over the past century, the private Federal Reserve has been doing nothing other than systematically devaluing and debasing the dollar while destroying the American economy in every way imaginable. This notion was just made that much more concrete after this year's central bank meeting at Jackson Hole. By any metric, the American economy has failed to recover in any way, and by most metrics, it is continuing to degrade at a dangerous pace. However, the mainstream media continues to pretend that none of this is true by pointing to small rallies in certain stock sectors and currencies as proof of investors starting to entertain the notion that the economy may yet avoid slipping back into recession, as Reuters reports. Where they get the support for this notion is beyond me. As even Bernanke, the current chairman of a private Federal Reserve cartel, has yet to present any solutions or even ways to mitigate this economic disaster. Instead of presenting a single solution, all Bernanke is able to do at this point is give hollow guarantees and weak assurances of an economic recovery. Take, for instance, Alan Ruskin, the head of G10 currency strategy at Germany's Deutsche Bank, who was quoted by Reuters as saying, and I quote, "For all the focus on QE issues, we should not lose sight of Bernanke's most important message that the Fed does not foresee the economy heading into renewed recession, even if there is plenty of fragility." End of course, quote. Of course, like Bernanke, Ruskin couldn't give a single concrete answer or solution if pressed to do so. Then again, the mainstream media fails ever to press for answers from these individuals, instead opting to pretend that these ambiguous and questionable statements are somehow legitimate. Even though plenty of options have been proposed by eminent and prestigious economists to get the country back on track, not a single one of these options has been offered as a solution by the corrupt and highly criminal banking cartels like the Federal Reserve and the International Monetary Fund, or their media lapdogs. So why is this? Because these organizations have no real interest in economic recovery, so long as it means clamping down on rampant speculation, high-frequency trading and stock manipulation, fraudulent savings and loan practices, and anything that impinges on the ludicrous profit margins afforded to multinational corporations thanks to free trade and globalism. Like their American counterparts, the overseas banking cartels are making ambiguous demands of politicians. Take, for example, the new chief of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, and her call on legislators to act now in order to prevent further economic downturns. No actual plans of action are ever presented. The only thing it seems these individuals are good for is making demands. Unfortunately, it is not demands which will put the world back on the road to recovery. Nor do they do anything other than create an atmosphere of fear. Pathetic. All right, well, let me take a question, or rather a comment, from Martin Wagner in Germany, who wrote in saying, "Hello, Richard. Thank you for responding so quickly." He must have written an email that I responded to. My question, though, was more of a general nature, and perhaps you could briefly comment on one of your upcoming shows. In Germany, the situation may differ markedly from other EU member states, in particular from the so-called Club Med. Nevertheless, one gets the idea that our politicians are running around like headless chickens. On the one hand, we're being told that the euro needs to be defended at all costs. Germany's current liabilities are 211 billion euros and still counting. Otherwise, the world as we know it would end and there will be all hell to pay and high water. Sounds familiar? The argument, the euro is a bastion of strength and a blessing. Germany's economy is doing so well, not despite, but because of the euro. Therefore, we should all be grateful, fall on our knees, and keep away from the heretics who would like to return our old currency, the Deutschmark. The role of Greece is being downplayed as the Greek economy supposedly only amounts to about 2% of the GDP in the European Union. Nevertheless, in my opinion, a default of Greece would start a domino effect with unforeseeable, potentially devastating consequences. Hence, there is a developing sense of panic and paranoia over here in Germany. Fear of inflation, deflation, and what have you, a flight into assets such as gold, real estate, foreign currencies, etc. On the other hand, the increasing lot of euro opponents argue that we would be much better off by leaving the eurozone as expedient as possible, i.e. Germany returns to the Deutschmark as the collapse of the euro, so they argue, is unavoidable. Then there is the issue of eurobonds, the proverbial straw that would, in my opinion, break the camel's back. Mrs. Merkel currently does not think eurobonds are such a good idea. Therefore, she takes a lot of flack from other member states of the EU, including the left wing of the Bundestag, the German parliament. And I pray she will not finally be pushed over the edge, since we are all too familiar with the power of the international banking cartel. My question to you, what scenario do you envision for the different European countries and the world economy as a whole should the euro collapse? Is there any place to run, or should I better stock up on oatmeal and dry goods? Finally, the whole situation concerning the botched up euro salvage and the pathetic part our politicians play in this travesty reminds me of a scene right out of Shakespeare's Macbeth, when, after several murders, Macbeth mollifies his bad conscience and justifies further assassinations with the following words. I am in blood stepped so far that, should I wade no more, returning were as tedious as go o'er. That's Macbeth himself. But don't we all know how that played out? As always, cheers, Martin. Well, Martin, I feel that you have possibly got almost there, but I think that you are ignoring the elements of Europe which are predominant in this issue, namely the individual nationalistic characteristics of every European country. Now, remember that the European Union was brought together as a defense against internecine conflict within Europe. Conflict and wars seem to have been the norm in Europe for the past 500 years, and up until the end of 1945, nothing seemed to indicate that that was going to change. And so France, in particular, pushed for some kind of European Union to push these countries artificially together in order to make them, as it were, toe the line and refuse ever to get involved in conflict with each other. Unfortunately, the differences in culture between the various European countries are so great that I don't believe any such union is feasible over the long term. And I said this right at the beginning, at the very start of the European experiment. I said that I doubted it would work. And as usual, of course, I was accused of being a pessimist, doom and gloom, and etc. But as usual, I was just being a realist. And I do think that there can be few countries on earth as different from each other as Germany and Greece. And I don't think it is an accident that it is those two countries which are now at loggerheads over what needs to happen in terms of harmonizing the economy and the system in Europe. And I don't think it's going to work. I really think that somehow, by hook or by crook, these different European countries, which have tried so hard to formulate a union, are going to have to go back to their individual status as independent economic units and independent social and cultural units, and they're going to have to make it work on their own. I have no idea what kind of conflict this will cause in the future. It may be that because of the horrendous troubles of the 20th century, we may have a few years yet to go before Europe starts to knock their heads together and give out more unpleasantness. But as things are right now economically, I think the whole issue of war transcends the European problem. I think it is certainly one of the United States and China, and I know that I will be talking a lot more about this in future shows. And it won't be to the benefit of the United States. So it'll be tough listening, ladies and gentlemen, but it needs things, certain things do need to be said, and I will not shrink from saying them. But finally, Martin, I'm afraid to tell you that I think that things look very grim for Europe. There will be an enormous amount of financial hardship in the years ahead. Nobody will escape. Germany in particular will suffer very serious downturns in its own economy, which probably explains why the stock market is so weak in Germany right now. As usual, countries which are already poor, like Greece, quite frankly, won't see poverty as that much of an imposition. It will be an imposition and it will hurt. But, you know, when you're coming from a high level, such as Germany or the United States, and I intend to talk about the United States in much more detail in future shows when it comes to how the changes are going to take place. But when you have so much further to fall, the meeting of body and sidewalk is that much more painful. This is what I fear we're going to have to look forward to, particularly in the northern European countries like Germany, Luxembourg, Belgium, Holland, and to a certain extent France. But France really straddles the north and the south, so difficult to give a proper analysis of the French situation. Okay, thank you very much. I hope I have given you some peace of my mind on that issue, Martin. Let's go to Susan Alexander, who wrote me an email saying, "Hi, Richard. I enjoy reading International Living. I noticed that while they recommend renting in a place for at least a year before purchasing, they encourage and market heavily for purchasing property abroad. One example tells the story of how one man was able to turn a $45,000 investment into a $3.5 million by leveraging properties to buy new ones and then renting them out to vacationers as luxury rentals. Do you believe that the housing bubble will affect Paris, Nice, and other sought-after spots? I've been listening to Johnny Miller's PRN show, The Expat Files, on living in Central and South America, and have found it very interesting and helpful. Johnny goes into all types of practical information regarding life south of the border. I highly recommend the show. Thanks for all your hard work and research. I simply love your show. Best regards, Susan." Okay, well, yes, please, ladies and gentlemen, do by all means go to Johnny Miller's PRN show, The Expat Files. I've heard very good things about it. Shame on me, I haven't actually listened to one yet, but that is definitely on my list of things to do. I very much approve of the idea of living in Central and South America, so that should be worthwhile listening. Mostly because it's close to the United States and you can come back and visit family really very easily, whereas if you live in Europe, in Asia, it is much more complicated. The issue of international living, which I have recommended and do recommend very highly, putting out real estate ads and recommendations, do understand that international living is not an economics site. real estate in foreign countries is part of their business. And as with so many publications from Agora Publications, you want to use the information for yourself as information. You don't necessarily want to subscribe to every single concept that they offer. They have to make a living, just like anyone else. They hope that they can attract some people to their wares, and good luck to them. I hope that they can succeed. And as I said, International Living is an excellent publication. They've got representatives all over the world, mostly, I think, for the time being, in Latin America and to some extent in Europe. But I wouldn't get involved with any of their programs. And I would definitely rent. If you are looking to live in any of these countries, please rent, first of all. Have a look around, see where you want to live, how the whole lie of the land affects you, and then make your decision accordingly. You don't want to be in a hurry when it comes to choosing where to live, even where to live in a rental accommodation. And when you go there, you can always live in these apart hotels. Apartment hotels where they have little suites, usually quite inexpensive, usually no more than the cost of a hotel room itself, by the way, where you get either a large bedroom which has a sofa and a kitchenette type arrangement, or else just a bedroom and an adjoining living area. And there you can repose, you know, where you take your time looking for a place to rent, or eventually maybe a place to live and buy, but don't buy sight unseen. And do by all means use the contacts that you will most certainly find with International Living to help you do this. They are very reputable, and I know certain people there, and so I couldn't recommend them more highly. So, yes, to answer your question, Susan, I do think the housing bubble will affect Paris, Nice, and other sought-after spots. It's already doing so. Do listen to the Progressive Radio Network show, The Expat Files, with Johnny Miller. I'm sure there's a lot of interesting information, and as I say, I couldn't recommend it highly enough. All right, well, let's take our break, and I'll be right back. Okay, we're back. And now I'm going to play devil's advocate for just a few minutes. One of the things that killed the incipient recovery in the 1930s was the arrival of a myriad of new rules and regulations as part of the New Deal. This caused a massive decline in 1937. Well, would you believe it, ladies and gentlemen, today we have the same kind of mindless intervention in all sectors of the economy. The financial services sector may consist of bad guys, but it is a major part of the economy. It has been harangued with legislation of more than 1,000 pages, including instructions to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, or the SEC, and other bureaucrats to write new, undefined regulations in all sorts of areas. Additionally, the mortgage business, one of their major profit drivers in normal times, has been subject to endless regulatory harassment and lawsuits. It's tough to sympathize with bankers, but it's also tough to imagine how they can grow their business and flourish under these conditions. The combined over-regulation and coddling of banks has suppressed small business lending to a level 25% below its pre-2008 plateau. Bango more jobs. Just like with banks, it's tough to sympathize with oil companies. But very few permits have been issued for offshore Gulf drilling in the last year, and exploration in the rest of the country has been shut down. Now, energy companies have devised a wonderful new technique, fracking, that has immensely increased U.S. natural gas reserves. Fracking has reversed the decline in national energy self-sufficiency for the first time since the 1970s. It's also created an estimated 140,000 jobs since January 2010. However, the Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, wants to restrict this development. Even New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has gotten into the act, imposing a 12-month fracking moratorium. Well, I'm sorry, but fracking has the potential to create more value, more national security, and more jobs than all the dubious toys of Apple, Google, Facebook combined. A new energy policy of drill, baby, drill, and frack, baby, frack could speed U.S. growth into a brisk trot, and it's not being allowed to happen. People hate banks and oil companies, but nobody much hates aircraft manufacturers. However, the National Labor Relations Board is attempting to impose sanctions on Boeing for opening a new plant in South Carolina rather than the unionized state of Washington. As a result, billions of investment dollars are being delayed while lawyers are deployed. Since December, Americans have been prevented from buying the light bulbs that they've used for 100 years and instead forced to buy inferior, much more expensive, foreign-made light bulbs, all for the benefit of a crony capitalist manufacturer, General Electric, which has closed its U.S. light bulb plants and moved manufacturing to China. Automobile manufacturers are being forced to increase fleet economy not just 35 miles a gallon, but possibly as high as 62 miles a gallon by 2025. Meanwhile, energy prices are rising, while hopelessly uneconomic energy sources such as bird-slaughtering windmills, earthquake-causing geothermal power, and famine-producing ethanol are being subsidized. A healthcare law of more than 2,000 pages has been enacted, imposing immense new costs and regulations on business, many of them avoidable with better legislation. The healthcare bill also widened the budget deficit and brought huge new uncertainty in the lengthy run-up to its implementation. A June 2011 survey on 329 large employers by the National Business Group on Health, a Washington-based nonprofit that represents large employers on national health policy issues, reports that employers estimate their health care benefit costs will increase an average of 7.2% in 2012. Another survey from professional service firm Towers Watson said 9% of the mid-size and large companies plan to drop employer-sponsored health insurance altogether after the Affordable Care Act takes effect in 2014. Congress has held up three trade treaties, two with major trading partners, Korea and Colombia, since 2007. The treaties actually would bring new growth opportunities. Meanwhile, Korea and Colombia already have signed trade treaties with the European Union and will focus more of their trade in that direction. Colombia's ambassador to the United States, Gabriel Silva Lujan, noted that U.S. farmers once claimed 46% of Colombia's food import market. Now the proportion is more like 20% and headed lower. Colombia also is the sixth largest market for Caterpillar's construction and mining equipment. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you may agree with some and disagree with other points that I've just mentioned, but their combined effect has been to suppress growth in the private sector and put the country into a permanent recession far worse than any since the 1930s. Add to this overregulation the adverse effect of the federal deficit, the uncertainty created by the default threats during the debt ceiling wrangling, S&P's downgrade of the U.S. credit rating, and the U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke's damaging monetary experiments. And quite frankly, it's surprising that the private sector does any business at all. Again, I'm afraid to say these changes are baked into the social cake. They are politically irreversible. Just another reason why it's time to get out of Dodge. I have to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, I know some of you are going to disagree with a lot of what I've said, but you are going to have to come down in the end to the cold, calculating decision. Is your country going to be allowed to fall into a depression far greater than the depression of the 1930s? That is the question. Now, I'm sorry, it's not going to be possible to have your cake and eat it. Either you're going to overregulate and just push the country into the bottom of the pit, or you have to allow things to happen which on an interim basis may be unpalatable, unpleasant, asocial to a certain degree, but it will put people back to work. all of the things that I have discussed in the last 5 minutes would put people back to work. There is no question about that. So decisions have got to come. And I'm not going to tell you what to think. You have heard what I have had to say, and you will make your own decisions, and that's exactly as it should be. But you need to know both sides of the picture here. Well, in the same kind of vein, but perhaps slightly off key here, the question of whether California is really the land of idiots or what. There's a new law almost certain to be passed, which reads as follows. Under AB 889, household employers, also known as parents, who hire a babysitter on a Friday night will be legally obligated to pay at least minimum wage to any sitter over the age of 18, unless it's a family member, provide a substitute caregiver every 2 hours to cover rest and meal breaks, in addition to workers' compensation coverage, overtime pay, and a meticulously calculated time card / paycheck. Failure to abide by any of these provisions may result in a legal cause of action against the employer, including cumulative penalties, attorney's fees, legal costs, and expenses associated with hiring expert witnesses. End of quote. Well, you heard it right, ladies and gentlemen. For 7 years in a row, a major survey of U.S. CEOs has ranked California as the worst state for business. Yet California lawmakers continue to pile on the rules, regulations, and taxes. Businesses are fleeing the state in droves, and the leadership of the state doesn't seem to care too much. Unemployment in many areas of California is over 20%, and the state has lost 1.2 million jobs over the last 3 years. The number of people unemployed in the state of California is approximately equal to the populations of Nevada, New Hampshire, and Vermont combined. Last year, only about 37% of the population of the entire state of California had a job. Hey, I guess you could, have dinner at a restaurant, and then between the main course and the dessert, one of you could run home and look after the babysitter for, how long is it, did they say? 2 hours, is it? Oh, no, they have to go every 2 hours. To give the poor babysitter a rest and a meal break, and then rush back for the coffee. I don't know, ladies and gentlemen, the more in trouble your country gets into, the more crazy the people seem to become. I just don't know. I mean, the mind boggles. I'm without any without any solution to this. You know, I can't offer anything except sympathy. All right, let's take a few more emails just coming in here. Linda wrote in saying, "Hi, Richard. If I have a large mortgage and a substantial amount of cash in the bank to pay it down at the time the bottom drops out in the U.S. economy, am I in good shape or should I be worried? If you read this on air, please don't mention my last name. Thanks so much. Best, Linda." Linda, my advice to you, pay that mortgage down. I mean, you're not going to be able to walk away from it if you really do have a large amount of cash. You're going to be got. They will catch you. So you really have no choice. Why pay interest to a bank when you have this substantial amount of cash you talk about and you don't pay it down, and then thereby saving yourself the interest payment? I mean, you're not going to be able to get as much in a bank in interest on your deposits as you will paying out to the bank in mortgage interest. So pay it down. Just pay it down. You're in good shape. Pay it off. That's my strong advice to you, Linda. Okay. Let me see. Louis Baroud wrote in saying, "When you and your wife were considering countries, what were the top five choices, and how did you make the final decision?" Good question, Lou. Thank you. We, very strangely enough, only thought about one country, and that country was Singapore. We visited several other countries. It used to be quite a joke. When we lived in southern Florida, whenever there was a hurricane, we got on a plane and went to a Central American country to see what it looked like. we went to Guatemala, we went to Costa Rica, to Panama, to Nicaragua. My wife just happens to like order. She likes to have things work. People who turn up when they say they're going to turn up, this is just her personality. So none of these countries fit the bill for her. You know, I'm a little bit more laid back about those things, but hey, no problem for me. She had heard about Singapore. She liked the idea. We went and visited Singapore in 2006. We loved it. Within 10 minutes, we felt that this was exactly the kind of place where we wanted to live. And so we started making arrangements, and here we are. Couldn't be happier. It's a wonderful place. And come on down, ladies and gentlemen. I'll show you around. All right. Michael Ridinger writes in saying, good evening, Richard. I'm considering buying one of the short financial ETFs, starts with F, before the market closes today, in anticipation of the U.S. lawsuit against banks before next Wednesday in their attempt to recover lost money at Fannie and Freddie. Any thoughts? Thanks for your wake-up call, Mike R. Well, Mike, frankly, I think that I'm not going to give any recommendations on the show. I'm not allowed to do that, so I'm not going to do it. But you know my feeling. The market is going down. Any investment that you may make in the stock market which reflects a falling market, I believe you will make money in. So take your choice and go with it. That's my advice to you. Okay. Okay, well, Bill Adamo writes in saying, Richard, fracking is really dangerous and it is being allowed. It ruins the water tables. Water is more important than gas. I'm conservative, but I don't want fracking. Thanks. All right, well, thank you for your piece. I told you I am not pushing for any of these things that I mentioned. I am just giving you a shopping list of the kind of things which will increase employment and thereby hopefully increase your standard of living. And where they say beggars cannot be choosers, I have to say people in depressions cannot really be choosers either. But that's maybe another way of looking at it. John Nevin writes in, Richard could not disagree with you more on the fracking. This is a disaster and a sham. You need to do some more homework on the reality of this, my friend. Thank you, John Nevin. John, again, I'm telling you, I'm just giving out some ideas. Some of you will agree with them, some of you will not. A lot of what I said will be a severe disagreement. But, I have to say there are a lot of things that do happen, or rather don't happen, that I think could happen and that would bring some employment back. I urge you to put yourself in the place of an unemployed head of a household with three or four children who has had no work for the last 18 months. Ask him what he thinks about certain of these things and understand that his numbers are growing dramatically, even though you're not hearing about it. I gave you the figures today of the unemployment situation. I told you what's going on and how they're fiddling the figures and how the figures are much worse than they make it seem. You need to think about these people too. And, quite frankly, if it takes the country going back in time over some of these hard-fought social programs and environmental programs, that may be how it's going to have to be. You know, you can't take liberties with financial affairs and economic affairs and expect there to be no consequences. What has happened in the last few years in the United States, in fact, in the last 30 years, have been liberties. People have been paid money they don't have access to, other than for the banks just giving it out freely. The governments have been giving away things. Look, I'm not saying it's good. I'm not saying it's bad. I refuse to take a position on this. But I will tell you, when a country spends more than it makes, there is payback time at one point. When payback time comes, you have to review all your alternatives. You cannot be in a position of somebody who gets the goodies and then gets sick then doesn't have to take the consequences. There are consequences, and there always have been, and I don't see that changing. You know, I'm afraid, I'm sorry, but I think that there are always cycles. There are good times and there are bad times, and the nature of the human race is such that they make injudicious decisions as things get better. And when you have balance and equilibrium, it is a recipe for disequilibrium, because like a flat pond, there will always be someone to throw a pebble in the pond, create the ripples, and the ripples in economic terms turn into waves, which themselves turn into tsunamis. And that is exactly where we are today. So, you know, when you disavow certain things which are on offer, be sure that you've got some form of suggestion to take their place, because otherwise your country is truly going to fall into the most outrageous chaos. Regrets really come late at that point. They don't apply. Let's have a look at an email from Liz, who says, Liz Summers, who says, "Hi, Richard. I greatly appreciate your show and take to heart your dire warnings concerning our economic future. Thank you. My question. I am totally confused about the money bailout the federal government has given to the big banks, including BOA. I read that the big banks have billions, if not trillions, of excess dollars in storage, just sitting there doing nothing. If so, why is it the BOA is on the verge of bankruptcy? Don't they have billions of our dollars to keep them afloat? Thank you again, and I apologize if my question is somewhat incoherent. I had to type it in a hurry. Liz Summers from Lawrenceville, Georgia." No, Liz, basically what these banks have is massive debts. They have basically huge inventories of unsold houses and other property and real estate that they have on their books since way back. They have inventory which is not even being disclosed, because they don't want to upset the price of real estate by putting it all on the market at the same time. They're in very serious trouble, all of these banks, for many reasons. They're upside down also on some of their derivative products. They owe money right, left, and center. They've made agreements with, for example, European banks, which are about to see tremendous drawdowns with countries that are in need of funds to support their capital balance sheets. The balance sheets themselves of the banks are in terrible disarray. The problem is that, just look at Bank of America right now, that took a $5 billion loan from Warren Buffett, paying 6%. I mean, if they're paying 6%, at a time when interest rates are at maybe 1 or 2%, Bank of America has got to be hurting. They need that money, Liz. They need the capital. And that's not going to be enough. I have no idea why Warren Buffett did something so ridiculous as to hand money over to Bank of America. His argument would be, well, if Bank of America goes down, the government will come in and backstop the Bank of America, just as they did in 2008, and Buffett will be saved. I think Buffett has made a serious miscalculation. The money isn't there this time round. The ability to borrow isn't there, such as it was in 2008. I don't think it's going to happen. I think Warren will lose this bet. It is very sad, but, you know, basically these banks are all insolvent, Liz. Much of their debts have been taken off their books and put onto the shoulders of the taxpayer, but the debts are still there, and these banks are all insolvent. And I was appreciative of your question. I really have been happy to answer it, and I hope that is satisfactory. John Nevin writes in, quickly before we go here, saying, "Richard, of course I agree with the desperate situation of people out there, but people like that are falling prey to these outfits that might give them a few bucks for the gas under their land. and they do make a few bucks for a little while, in some cases. Then, when the drillers leave, they have brown water that kills their animals and makes them all sick, really sick. So fracking is not a viable solution. Of course, I'm in agreement with the big guys looting us and leaving us for dead. There is plenty we could do to revive this country and return to the local economies in the best sense of that concept. And I surely would support that. No need to follow up. Thanks for the great program. Well, I appreciate it. And anybody else who wants to write in or talk about fracking or anything else, you're more than welcome to do so. And I will be happy to reflect your comments. So, ladies and gentlemen, it's been, as always, a pleasure. And it remains for me to wish you a wonderful three-day weekend. And be back next Friday, as always. Remember, no show on Monday. This is Richard Martin wishing you all the best. See you soon. Take care. Bye-bye.